Hello, dear internet strangers. Today is October 31st, and we are talking in obscurity. I'm Kevin Carlson, and I'm joined by my co-host,
Steve Kubitz.
And today, we're joined by a special guest,
James Reinhardt.
And we are talking about The Hellbound Heart by Clive Barker.
Yeah, so this was my pick, and I gotta be honest, I just wanted something that would be a little feel-good story.
And you always bring this up, that I'm a sad story person.
And to be honest, nothing feels better than going to an alternate dimension where torture is pleasure. So, wait, what?
What is... what?
So, that's... I'll work that on therapy. I'll work that on therapy next time. But the fact is, this is one of those stories where it really feels like... I love this story. It's one of my favorite horror, Hellraiser is one of my favorite horror movies of all time. And this book, this novella, really stuck with me in the years since I've read it. Mm-hmm. And so I really was excited to sort of jump into it for the podcast and sort of really analyze it. So this really felt like a exciting opportunity to see what happens when you get sent to straight to horny jail.
Yeah, this film is a cautionary tale, but literally not film, a book. I'm sorry.
He's from a film podcast originally. So.
Yeah. I do some movie podcasts, my first book podcast. But yeah, this is literally a story about a guy who gets sent to horny jail.
Well, I was going to bring up in this, it's funny that you mentioned film, that I had never seen the movie before I read this novella. And I read the novella and I watched the movie at the same time to see that how they compared to each other. And I felt like the movie's actually very consistent to the novella. But yeah, I think, so I'm going to bring that up a lot. But I think we're good to move on into what we like about this.
Yeah. And so my main like of this is, it's the same whether you're the movie or the novella, I like how unknowable the Cenobites are. And I think that there's something to be said about, if you want to call them a villain, it's hard for me to call them villains in this.
They're antagonists.
Yeah, they're really just more antagonists. Yeah, they're not really villains.
They just do what they do. They're like a force of nature.
Yeah, and
Frank's the villain. The Cenobites are...
Yeah.
I mean, they're there. They're antagonists, but they're not the main villains.
And I love the fact that, they're just... You don't really know what they're... Why. They just are. Mm-hmm. And there's something very horrifying, but also kind of exhilarating about them just being this unknowable force that shows up. And I can't remember... I think it's a quote from the movie, not the book, but the, "You called us, we came."
Yeah,
and that's it. You open the box, and we showed up. That's it. There's no other reason for us being here other than that's what it is.
I think that's in the novella too.
I think that is too. Yeah.
Whenever she's in the hospital, I don't want to spoil anything, but there's a hospital scene. Yeah. But building off what you said, one of my likes about this is that it feels kind of agnostic on where the Cenobites come from. Like the human characters have these theories that they're demons, and the other side of things is hell, and the Cenobites themselves don't actually explain themselves. They don't claim to be Satan or his pal. They don't claim that there's a god or angels or anything like that. They are just these things that experience pleasure and pain simultaneously. And there's something weird and unknowable, and I like that they don't specifically take a religious angle definitively all around.
I think it's scarier if something doesn't define. It gives you enough that you can fill in the gaps, but doesn't define if it's heaven or hell or religious. Like you and I have talked at length about you, Kevin. I spoke to Kevin. But Kevin and I have talked at length about Event Horizon. Mm-hmm. Event Horizon has a really interesting hook.
Until it doesn't.
And then they give a name to it. They said this ship went to hell. We talked about it. It's a little less scary that you know where that ship went. And it's a lot like this, and I think this novella does really well, is establish that there's some sort of other world, some sort of other culture that's always sort of like barking at the door of our realm. Mm-hmm. And, this box, Le Marchand's configuration, is the thing that you can open that door and let a little bit of that other realm in. And I think this book does that really well. It doesn't really describe that. It gives you enough that you can fill in clues and use your imagination to imagine what exactly these things are, where they come from, and it teases you enough, and it doesn't go too deep into what exactly
they're. Yeah, I mean, my second great like of this, what I love about this book is, like, the atmosphere, to build off what you're saying there. The atmosphere itself of this novella feels like a character in of itself. It's always oppressive. And it doesn't, there are not too many settings within the story. They don't go to many different places, but, like, everywhere feels oppressive, and there's always just something about, like, how characters are using everyone around them. Everybody's sort of using each other for reasons. Like, some of them are more benign and they're not nefarious, but nobody is doing things just out of purely out of the good of their heart. They all have these kind of ulterior motives.
I describe it as suburban gothic, where it's the stories where, you know, it's the idyllic suburban life, but, you know, obviously there's more going on under the surface with these people than you think. And that's very much the case in the novella The Hellbound Heart, where it's seemingly set in this sort of idyllic suburban neighborhood. You have the happy husband with what he believes to be the happy trophy wife, Julia. And obviously we see that Julia is very unhappy. She feels like she's missing something. You know, she's not really, she's missing something. There's a hole in her. You know, obviously her husband doesn't know or doesn't seem to care, that probably a little bit of column A and column B.
Yeah.
So this could very much be like a suburban domestic drama, but then you have demons in it and you have guys coming back from the dead and you have murder. So it just kind of amps.
Mutilation,
yeah. It really amps up what it is basically just, like, I always say the best horror stories are dramas, but they have these horrific elements. And this is basically a drama about, like, this woman who, on the surface, you would think has it all, but she still has this hole inside of her, and she's trying to fill that hole, and just all the damage she causes trying to do that. And that's what I really like about stories like this. Not just The Hellbound Heart, which I think does it really well, but a lot of stories like
that. I think that, like, what makes this story, before I get into my second, like, to sort of piggyback off what you're saying, is that this story is all about it sort of like takes and turns on the head what you would think of the ideal nuclear family would be. This guy is a well-to-do, you know, comes from a decent family. He's not the black sheep of the family.
Yeah.
He's the kid that the parents loved, and he was really good. And he married this beautiful woman that, you know, by all accounts, should be head over heels. He's described as very handsome. That's one thing that's fascinating. He's not just this, like, ugly, like, frumpy dude. He's described as very handsome.
And he's successful.
Yeah. All the things that would scratch the sort of ideal sort of 1970s, but I think it's set in London, or at least in England, sort of perfect life. And this woman is just miserable.
Yeah.
And there's something to be said about sort of whenever you idealize somebody, and not to get in the spoilery part of this yet, but she idealizes one of the other characters, because they're not really anymore, they become perfect.
Yeah.
That they become everything that could possibly make you happy. And I think that's, you can spend your entire life trying to reach for something perfect and never touch anything real. And this story is sort of all about that. She's constantly reaching for this thing that she considers perfect, but it's not real. And she pays the ultimate price, and everyone around her pays the ultimate price of sort of that idealization.
Yeah. So what is your second line?
My second line, honestly, is that, like, I love the fact that the sort of the main monster of the novella, the Cenobites. Well, that's not really being, because everyone knows Hellraiser, Cenobites.
Yeah.
They can be reasoned with. I love a movie monster you can reason with. Michael Myers, when he comes to you, you're dead. You can't talk to him like, well, I know where your sister is.
Unless you're Corey at Halloween Ends.
Which I've not seen yet, so...
Check out, I'm on another podcast talking about that movie, so it's good.
You can plug it.
Plug that.
You know, and I like a monster you can sort of talk to and have a sort of a moment with where you can go, no, you don't want me, you want
this thing.
And there's something to be said about a monster that isn't just a mindless killer, that is just, you can sort of have a conversation with, reason with, and they go, okay. But if you end up, this doesn't work out, we're taking you. Because that there's stakes to that. It isn't just, okay, well, but they're still, at the end of the day, they want what they want.
Yeah.
And that's their literal pound of flesh. And I love the fact that they really are reasonable beings in their version of what reasonable is.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I think we're going to move on into our dislikes for this, and I'll go first on that. In the novella, I don't like any of the human characters. I think that they're all very uninteresting people. Where this is different is because, like I said earlier, I had watched the movie while I was reading the novella, and the character of Kirsty in the movie, I was much more sympathetic to that character, how that actress played her, and her relationship with
Larry. In
the movie. It's a father-daughter relationship.
Yeah,
it's a father-daughter relationship. Yeah, like it was a father-daughter relationship in the movie, but in the novella, it's this woman that is just mooning over.
It's unrequited love.
Yeah,
yeah.
That was an interesting change because obviously Clive Barker, who wrote the novella, he wrote and directed the movie. I thought it was really interesting that Kirsty in the movie, the character's name is Larry in the movie. She's his daughter from a previous relationship. Her and Julia don't get along. It's like the wicked stepmother sort of thing. So she's just, I think her motivation is more relatable in the movie, where she's a daughter worried about her dad. She's just looking out for her dad.
Yeah. It makes so much more sense. I think
it's so much. I actually like the movie version of the dynamic more than the novella version of the dynamic.
I'm not sure. I mean, I really like I think it works in a movie. It gives you a final girl you really root for, where she doesn't like Julia to begin with. She starts to suspect Julia's up to no good, so she's just trying to help her dad. I did feel a little bit sorry for the character of Kirsty in the book, obviously pining over this guy who doesn't give a shit about her because he has a hot wife. And that's obviously ultimately a thing, is like he only really sees Julia for being hot. He doesn't care about this girl.
Yeah, which leads me into why I think that Larry in the movie, I forget the character's name in the novella now.
Rory.
Okay, yes. I think that character is more likable in the movie as well. But in the novella, he's just using her as that friend that he keeps on the side to do things for him. Like, hey, help me move. Or, hey, go check in on my wife. I think she's starting to go a little wonky. And there's nothing about Julia that seems nice. She just seems like very fake person, and obviously she has her problems. And we get into a brother character, and he's a peach.
Oh, Frank. Yeah, brother Frank.
Oh, Frank's a peach. And really in every version of this.
So, Frank's always terrible.
Like I said, I agree and disagree, because I did like the character of Kirsty in this, but I do agree that these characters are not very deep or complex. I do tend to like stories about unlikable people or morally gray people. So I was kind of along for this ride. I did really like looking into the lives of these deeply unhappy people, because I tend to like those kind of stories.
I think that they're also they aren't very likable because they're just not fleshed out.
Yeah, exactly.
And we had a conversation at one point about like how there isn't a lot of time in a novella to do this, but I would argue that you can do good character development in almost any space of time. And we were discussing the wife character at the beginning of Up. We know her for a minute or two, and yet whenever she's gone,
we're devastated.
You're profoundly sad.
It was very sad when they stopped drawing her.
Yeah.
It was very sad.
But it was.
I once had a conversation with somebody, I don't remember who it was, and they were like, "Well, you didn't cry during the beginning of Up?" I'm like, "Why not?" I'm like, "Because I know real people that have died." I'm sad, but I mean, like, come on. They stopped drawing the character. There are worse crimes.
I think that was character development done.
It was perfectly done. Absolutely.
Very quickly, and it still was emotionally very effective, where when anything bad happened to any of these characters in the novella, I did not feel in my emotional core, oh no.
That is a really good point. But yeah, I agree with you. I think I give it a pass because there's a writing rule that I followed where if you're doing a simple story, the characters could be more complex. But if you're doing something more high concept kind of out there, make the characters sort of simple because the audience can sort of get these characters while you're hitting them with a really big story, a really crazy idea. And if you're doing the story about S&M demons from another dimension.
For example.
Yeah. The characters kind of got to be simple archetypes that the audience can really digest easily.
Yeah, that's a great point.
That is, yeah, that's actually, I never really thought of it that way.
I like that is This is why we invited you.
That's why, like, Avatar was such... I mean, just, Avatar is such a big hit because, like, the characters aren't particularly deep, but Cameron's introducing this new world, this new people, this new, you know,
technology. I wouldn't say that his story is very innovative, being that it dances
with... Yeah, exactly. But he's... It's easy for the audience to digest because he's introducing this really new, like, tableau, but he's having a very simple universal story, very simple characters. That's why people... Same with Star Wars. Star Wars... is like all these new sci-fi concepts, but like it's a very familiar story. Yeah. So you can have these very, the audience can kind of digest this knowing these archetypes that they're familiar with. And you know, Clive Barker's doing that with this, where he's like, you know, what if you get horny enough and you solve this puzzle and these demons come and fucking kill you? And
They don't kill you. They take you to the other
place. Take you to horny jail. You know, yeah.
It's funny because I feel like that's such a good point because. If you're going to introduce like high concept characters, like this isn't a similar thing at all, but kind of is a Marriage Story.
Yeah.
Those are two very complex, very fleshed out, multifaceted characters. You couldn't do that story. Oh, by the way, there's also demons that come out. And,
Because zombie apocalypse wouldn't work.
It'd be too much going on. The audience would be like, well, okay, I'm so confused because these people are like, who am I rooting for?
Yeah.
But when you know for a fact that like everyone's pretty simple where it's, oh, this is the unrequited love character. This is the... sort of shitty, like, workaholic husband character. This is the evil, sort of bored housewife. You simple it, then you can throw these weird things in there. Okay, I get it. I don't need to worry about these characters as much as the concept.
Yeah, yeah.
To play devil's advocate, though, on this, before we move on, I think that you could do complex characters like that, but you can't do it in one story. That's more of a series sort of thing. Because you get into... Game of Thrones is a high concept story. Mm-hmm. It's political theater with dragons.
Yeah.
And yet there are very complex characters that have very complex motivations. And that's because you have a lot of time. If you look at the first story in A Song of Ice and Fire, Ned Stark is he's just the honorable guy. And everybody's sort of like that early on.
Yeah.
But as you go on with time in that story, everybody has so many different sides. And I think that you can have a story that has a big, sweeping, high concept and yet still have complex characters. It just takes more time.
But I think a novella is not the right...
Yeah. Sure. No, I agree.
It's not the right platform.
Kevin has very good points about, you know, up and using a small amount of time to develop a character and, you know, what he said, like, there was a way to do it. I just feel like, you know, I do agree with ultimately what Kevin's criticism is a bit. I just feel like if you're good, and a lot of horror films do this, where if you're going to introduce this crazy concept, you know, have the characters be easy for the audience to digest.
Yeah, and I think that this story the characters themselves are very easily digestible. I think they're very, like, I think they're simple, but I also think that because they're kind of unlikable and flawed, that gives them sort of instant depth. Mm-hmm. Because honestly, I feel like you see this a lot in, like, fiction where people really hate the character that's like the boy Superman.
Yeah.
Oh, he's so perfect all the time. And that bores people. Even though Superman is not boring, but screw everyone thinks he is. But this story, because they're kind of unlikable, you honestly, it's like how people confuse like bluntness with being a jerk. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is an example of people that are absolutely kind of awful, but because of that, it almost masquerades as depth. And it makes you then feel a little sympathy for when they go through the things they go through.
Nah, I didn't feel bad at all. But moving on to my other dislike, as another character, is the engineer right at the end. It's just like, this Cenobite's different. He's the engineer. And why is he different? He just is. Like, and he's just introduced at the end of the story. We meet him, and then it's the end of the story. And like, it's just... I felt that was a weird off note.
To piggyback off of that, because my final dislike is that the story, because of that, just stops. It doesn't really end. It just stops. Right. And which I kind of forgive because it is a novella. Mm-hmm. So how do you have a big ending? But I do feel like when you're done, let's be honest again, we all listen to this on Audible. We all know we did. So when you're like, wait a minute, that's the final? I'm looking at my phone like, that's it?
Yeah, it feels a lot like this. I didn't write this down for dislikes, but it feels like part of a story.
Yeah,
like it's not a novella where I've read a lot of novellas where it's a complete story, and I think that to plug The Expanse again, they do novellas between some of the major novels, and my favorite one is called Oberon, and it's a complete story. It's a novella, and it has the benefit of you're playing off of knowledge from prior novels and stuff, but it doesn't have that feeling at the end of the 3 hours that just felt like part of a story.
Don't you find it funny that the word novella is longer than the word novel, but it means a shorter story?
You're so profound.
So I do agree with both of you guys on that. Like, the novella feels very abrupt. And I feel like, you know, a lot of horror stories have to end with a certain, like, little button at the end. I feel like Clive Barker didn't know what button he wanted to end this on. So he's just like, well, here's the engineer. But knowing that, you know, he wrote and directed the movie, I feel like he saw the movie as a second draft of this story. Because the ending of the movie I do like better.
Yeah, I agree.
Because, you know, the ending is essentially the same, where the Cenobites get Frank.
Spoilers. We're close to the spoiler section.
I guess
I'm just busting you out.
Yeah, but they get Frank, but then they decide they're going to take Christy anyways. They're going to go back on their deal. And so we get this chase as the Cenobites chase Christy. And she gets a little bit more agency as a character. She has a lot more agency, I think, in the movie.
Yeah.
But Christy sort of deals with Cenobites. And then her and her dude, they escape the house. And then they throw the puzzle box into, like, a fire. And the homeless guy, who's been sort of harassing Christy the whole movie, he comes by, lifts the box out of the fire, and he turns into this demon and flies away. And I felt like that was a much stronger ending than this, because, like, it does what I said this did earlier, where it hints that there's this larger world, there are forces in, you know, interacting with us that we don't understand. They're probably terrifying. And that, like, ending never really... There's no explanation to the ending. There's no explanation. Who this homeless guy is. And then all of a sudden he's a fucking demon. And he flies off the box. And then the end of the movie is the guy... You know, the movie begins and ends with the line, "What's your pleasure?" We see that guy in that marketplace selling the box to Frank. And now to someone else. I think that's a much stronger end. So that this cycle just continues.
It never ends. Yeah. There's always someone looking for unknowable pleasure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And... that's sort of the crux of what this story is. It's when you get to a certain point of pain, it almost becomes like, it's like, you ever heard the expression "hurt so good"?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, that's what this sort of story is. It's about people sort of finding that line in the most extreme way imaginable of when pain starts to be like good.
It's also, like, you know, Frank is a sexual predator, and the Cenobites are a different breed of sexual predators. Like, Frank... it's just kind of, he has no plan. He's just kind of leaving. He's just kind of waging a warpath, you know, across the globe, as we find out. Like, he goes all over the world looking to fill this void in him. Whereas the Cenobites, very clearly, they have a plan and they have this box and they know some fucker is going to be horny enough to solve this box. And then that's when they get their jollies.
I think they even say that there are other ways to call them. It's not just the box. That's just the thing that Frank found.
Mm-hmm.
Implies, again, that there's a bigger world, that there are other ways that summon the Cenobites.
It's funny. The actual way to call Cenobites is, you remember 10-10-220? who needs that? And that's actually it. If you use 10-10-220, Cenobites would show up.
Imagine, a bunch of girls at a sleepover, you know, like, playing off the Ouija board, and they accidentally call Cenobites. He's just like,
oh, boy. So,
then I like to imagine a scenario, though, where it's like Pinhead just gets into it, and like there's a scene where Pinhead gets like a weird montage of him getting makeup and like, getting a makeover. Given the Netflix movies that got retconned now because of the new Hellraiser movie, Time, that would have been the end game of Hellraiser.
Oh, yeah, is Pinhead at a sleepover?
And then to look around, the world pretty babies playing in the background as they're doing his, like, they're trying to do his hair, but they can't get it in the nails.
So I think we're done with the dislikes, unless anybody has anything else.
I just like the fact that you clearly were uncomfortable by my Pinhead getting a makeover job.
You know, fair.
That's what I dislike. That's my main dislike now. It's number one.
We're going to move on into the spoiler side of this. Yeah. We're going to get into our analysis of the story. And James, why don't you start us off? I think you had some really good points.
So, I really like noirs, and there are two different kinds of noirs. There's the detective noirs that we all know, the hard-boiled, like, you know, detective, in, you know, silhouetted in his office, and the dame comes in, and he's got to solve the mystery. But then there's what I call domestic noirs, which are typically stories about two people that engage in an affair, And usually it's like a man and a married woman, and then they hatch a plan to kill her husband. Usually the old archetype is to collect the insurance money. That's the movie Double Indemnity. But another great example is a postman always rings twice. They're trying to kill the married woman's husband and take over his company on his business.
Also, Don't Throw Mama from the Train is a turn on that head of that sort of story.
Where I've actually never seen that one.
Oh, that's a great. You should see it.
But it's a classic noir plot. Typically they commit this murder and then, everything goes wrong.
The whole thing with Frank is that we're talking about how this is a... You get so horny and you solve this puzzle box, and he did, and this Cenobite showed up and they did a number on him.
I love the brutal. It's not even just physical torture. It's like sensory overload, which I found so fascinating. Yeah. Because in the movie, it's literally my favorite horror movie of all time. I've been very consistent with that. It's always been my it's my gold standard horror movie, and the movie is very physical. It's very much like we take our flesh, we do that. I like the description of Frank being. He remembers everything he's ever remembered. He tastes everything he ever tasted. He smells everything he ever smelled. Imagine how overwhelming that would be and how horrific that would be.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that that's the first thing the Cenobites do to him. There's no chains, there's no hooks, the first thing they do to him is they just overwhelm him completely.
He does ask for sensation, and they give it to him.
And his existence is he gets stuck on the other side of this, and it's the ultimate, what was the joke of the stuck-in-the-wall porn?
It's stuck-in-the-wall porn. What are you doing, step-pinhead?
Well, it reminds me of The Dark Knight Rises, where Bane says there could be no true despair without hope, where, he imprisons people in that underground prison with a view of the outside.
And a rope.
And a rope that they keep trying to climb and failing at it. And, in this, Frank still has a view of the outside world. He's imprisoned in his walls. So that really just adds to the torture. It's like he's in this extreme... He's mutilated to the point where he's unrecognizable, but he has a glimpse into the outside world. I really like that. I really liked that, Frank is one of... in a movie, you infer, there are other people. Mm-hmm. But in the book, there are thousands of others that the Cenobites are torturing. Frank is just, a number.
Yeah, and they kind of forget that he's there, but they're very upset later on whenever they find out he's escaped.
Yeah,
and but to play back on that idea of the noir is that so Frank's way out is that he seduces his brother's wife, and it's all about blood, and the vital force, and so he convinces her to start killing random guys, and eventually that's not enough, and he has to replace his brother. And so it's got that whole to get his second chance, to get his new life, he has to kill her. He has to convince her to help him kill her husband.
What's interesting about that is in the movie, it's in the novella, she clearly doesn't love her husband at all. Mm-hmm. She has no guilt about him being killed. There's a scene in the movie where Roy's character is Larry in the movie. Is having sex with Julia, and you see Frank standing in the background, and she's like, no, don't. Mm-hmm. You can tell she has guilt about, she knows that her husband's a good guy.
Yeah.
He just doesn't satisfy her. But he's still a good man. And I think that that's where the movie is a little bit better in terms of their relationship. There's a little bit of love, but it's not a lot. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the novella, there's no love between Rory and Julia.
Yeah.
So whenever you get that scene where Frank's wearing his brother's skin, I actually feel like it doesn't have as much weight as the movie version, even though it's a little more horrific.
Well, it's definitely everything's more horrific in the novella because there are some scenes like we talked about the psychological aspect, but there are some physical scenes that are way worse in the novella with I think it was in the opening scene whenever he's seeing that that one female Cenobite, and there are all these just tongues just on her, severed tongues or something to that effect.
Yeah.
That is something I liked about the Cenobites in general. They're not, you don't really get many descriptions of them. Obviously the iconic one is Pinhead, And there's like one line at the beginning of the book, like, oh, one of them with, you know, tattoos and pins in their head spoke. But the Cenobites are tortured to the point where Frank can't even tell, like, their gender. He can't tell if he's talking to a man or a woman. And, like, what he thought was clothes was, like, their skin. Like, I really like that. And, but they don't really give you that many. They don't go in depth with the detail. It just gives you enough that you're like, oh,
these. You can use your imagination.
Yeah. Which is always going to be the worst version.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, to go back to the noir thing, I love that this is essentially a domestic noir plot, but what if there were demons where, you know, it's a guy sleeping with his brother's wife and they concoct a plan to murder the brother, except in this case, you know, he's trying to regenerate his skin and he needs her to, you know, kill his.
Well, his whole character is about consuming people, and he uses people and he uses them up. He even does that to Julia eventually, is where he just...
It's never enough.
It's never enough for him, because I think you even said to me, like, his whole thing was, hey, he just needs one more, and it's never enough.
Yeah.
It never will be enough.
Yeah, the whole point is Frank, you know, Frank and Julia are both very empty people, so looking to fill that emptiness. And, you know, the metaphor of this, you know, Frank is literally stripped bare. Like, he is nothing. And he's saying, like, oh, I just need to consume one more and I'll be whole. I need to do one more and I'll be whole. Like, he keeps telling himself that eventually that next fix is going to give him what he's always been, that high he's always been chasing. But it never is. And Julia, you know, she's sort of the same coin as Frank. It's a different side where, you know, she's clearly unhappy in her life. She's clearly unhappy in her marriage. And she feels like this is the guy that's going to give her what she wants. Like, oh, this guy loves me. This guy's going to treat me right. Like, we're going to, once he says that, you know, once he gets his ship, whatever he wants, we're going to run away. It's like that, you know, you see that in a lot of movies where the two characters having an affair and, like, the woman's like, oh, yeah, he says he's going to leave his wife for me. He's going to do that, you know. And
run away to Paris.
Yeah, yeah. And it never happens. But that's very much the case where Julia's like, oh, once he's whole, like, we're gonna run away together. We're going to be happy together. And, you know, Julia's, you know, never going to be happy. And Frank's obviously never going to be. And, you know, Frank, I think, is self-aware enough about that. You know, obviously, at the end, the predictable twist happens where Frank consumes Julia. You know, he never gave a shit about her. She thought he did, but she was just another body to be consumed, and he's still not feeling complete.
What I love about the touch of the portrayal at the end is that in the movie they clearly just have sex.
Mm-hmm.
In the novella, though, it's very strongly implied that he just raped her.
Yeah,
but she eventually, in the trauma of it, or just trying to mask it, decided that she was consensual and she liked it.
Yeah.
But it's very strongly implied that she just went upstairs and she got raped.
Yeah.
And that it's more of what makes her... She's actually a very tragic character in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Because instead of dealing with her own trauma, she just decided that she liked it.
Yeah.
And she decided that, no, she wants more of it. And that she loves this man that did this to her. Because, no, it was consensual. I liked it.
It's mm-hmm. like it's Stockholm Syndrome.
But it's Stockholm Syndrome from afar, because he's literally in another dimension for most of, you know.
It's the hold an abuser has over the victim, even from afar. Like, he's, like you said, he's in another dimension, but he still has this power over Julia.
And I like the fact, I actually think that's a touch that the novella does a lot better, is I like the fact that he probably just raped her, but because she can't process that grief, and she's already kind of unhappy as it is. So instead of dealing with it, she decides, oh, no, I wanted it because I love this man.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something really heartbreaking about that. So it makes her death at the end really devastating.
Yeah, well.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'll give you that. It's much sadder now.
Now
that you pointed that out, I feel bad about saying I don't like any of them and I didn't care.
Well, you can be unlikable and still be a victim.
Yeah.
They're unlikable victims. We talked about that in our last podcast. You can be on the side. You can be on the side of the oppressed and still be a piece of shit.
Yeah. I mean, because that was our conversation about Titus.
And this is literally a story about what happens when you let your lust control you. It not only does it dehumanize you, it dehumanizes the people around you, your victims, or just the people you use trying to get that fix. Is, you know, you become a monster, and eventually, you know, you're just consuming this. They're not people to you anymore. You're just consuming them, and, you know, the chains from the Cenobites, they're, you know, literally like the chains and hooks of Frank's lust that's controlling him. Like, he's always had those hooks in him, but now they're just, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point. I was about to transition into, if you thought the movie was a horny movie. horny novella.
The novella is, that's our parting thoughts now, is an example of what happens when you let your need for sexual and sensual pleasure overtake your entire being. Mm-hmm. And these are two people, Frank and Julia, that have let sexuality become their entire essence. And not to the point where it isn't even about the release anymore. There's actually a great bit in the beginning of the book where Frank is masturbating.
Yeah.
But it's like the least pleasure. Mm-hmm. He's just doing it. It's not that it's he has any desire.
It's compulsive.
It's compulsive. And there's something really, it's like tragic, because, you know, masturbation, self-pleasuring yourself, you know, pleasuring yourself, you know, it's in the thing. It's supposed to feel good. But it's so mundane to him that it's a perfect metaphor for how he views sexuality in general. Mm-hmm. It's just a thing you have to do. It's scratching an itch. It doesn't matter if it feels good or it's irrelevant how it feels. Mm-hmm. It's just you have to do it. Mm-hmm. And there's something really sad and heartbreaking, but also just so villainous about a character that is so driven by desire, but the desire is meaningless.
Yeah. And like, and to get into our, like you said, we're wrapping up here. It's really a story about addiction, and I'm just thinking about that now, where, like, in the addiction in this is...
Sex addiction.
It is about that carnal pleasure above everything, to the point where it destroys his pursuit of more pleasure. Not just destroys him, it destroys his brother, and destroys his brother's wife, and it's a huge tragedy for all of these people around him. He doesn't just have this problem and he goes away forever and in horny jail, but he drags everyone down around him.
It's an example of, and anyone out there can really, if you've been raised by an addict parent or anyone that's in your life, like a partner that's been addicted to drugs or anything like that, inevitably the addict will consume everyone around him in a way, or around her, that it becomes to the point where you honestly lose your sense of self, because you're just so, you become just another thing for this person to use. Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, Frank as a character is so driven by his own innate sort of wants that he almost forgets that these are people that he should, like, love. There's so much heartbreak in the fact that you learn that him and his brother were best friends as kids. And think about how addiction drove him so far that he could then murder that person that he had love with, that he was deeply loved. He was his best friend, his brother, and he could then go. He was so ingrained in his sort of desires of addiction that it didn't matter that he could murder. Mm-hmm. He could murder his brother and wear his skin.
Yeah. Well, you have anything else you want to add before?
No, I think you guys summed it up.
Okay. Now it's my pick.
What's your pick next?
We're gonna do Annihilation, which is the first book in the Southern Reach trilogy. And if you want to read the rest of the Southern Reach trilogy, I'd say that it's okay.
It's funny. This is one of those podcasts. It's a book podcast, but this is now will be the second in a row. We do this a lot where we have things that also have, like, movie versions.
Yeah, I mean, Annihilation has. I think that the movie with Natalie Portman is
it's okay.
Mm-hmm. But, like, it's a short novel. It's a little bit longer than a novella, where Annihilation is one of my favorite cosmic horror stories I've ever read, because it does a thing that, like, you really can't do too well in movies, where you don't learn all the characters are they're described by their title, instead of, like, having traditional character names. But I don't want to get to
that. Yeah. I'm excited to get into it, and I've seen the movie. The movie, actually, I like the movie a lot. There's scenes in that movie that have stuck with me for a long time, so yeah. I'm really excited to get to this sort of novel and really get to sort of bite into it and really get to discuss it at length. So that'd be fun.
Yep.
As fun as that can be.
I like cosmic horror. So we'll see you next time.